heard it for the first time in this room. It was ticking away in the walls. You can go over to that wall and listen for it if you like." Lewis got up and walked over to the book-lined wall. He put his ear to a row of black leather volumes and listened. His eyes opened wide. "It is there, Uncle Jonathan. It is." He was excited by the discovery, but then his face changed. He looked afraid. "What is it for, Uncle Jonathan? What does it do?"
"I haven't the faintest idea," said Jonathan, "though I know that I want to blot it out. That's why I have all these stupid clocks. I didn't used to be so fond of incessant ticking and sudden loud hell-raising every hour on the hour, but I prefer my clocks to his."
Jonathan's face had turned grim. He shook his head, smiled a little half-hearted smile, and went on.
"You may be wondering why I don't just tear down the wall and rip out the clock. Well, it wouldn't do any good. It sounds like it's behind every wall, up in the attic, down in the cellar, in the closets and storerooms and parlors, and sometimes it seems to be slowing down. I keep hoping it'll stop, but then it picks up and keeps going. I don't know what to do."
There was a note of real despair in his voice. For a minute Lewis thought his uncle would cry. Then Mrs. Zimmerman broke in.
"I'll tell you one thing you ought not to do, Jonathan Barnevelt. You oughtn't to frighten Lewis with something you don't know anything about. After all, the ticking may be some leftover magic from the old Coots experiments, or death watch beetles, or an illusion of some kind, like in houses that have whispering galleries. I get a funny kind of hum in my head now and then. It goes, doo, for a while, and then it goes away."
Jonathan looked irritated.
"Oh, Florence, there's no need to kid around. You don't think it's something harmless, and neither do I. I wouldn't have told Lewis just to frighten him, but I thought it would be better for him to know about the clock than to think that his uncle was getting ready for the loony bin. You see, he caught me making my nightly rounds."
"Well," said Mrs. Zimmerman, "I don't know about the loony bin, but Uncle Jonathan had better be getting ready for Betty Bye if he's going to take us on a picnic tomorrow."
She reached into the folds of her dress and pulled out a silver watch on a long chain. She popped the lid open and announced that it was 3 a.m. Jonathan looked up with surprise.
"It is? Good grief, I had no idea—"
"Please, Uncle Jonathan," said Lewis, interrupting, "can you tell me one thing more?"
"Sure, Lewis, what is it?"
Lewis looked fidgety and embarrassed.
"Well, if the clocks are supposed to drown out the noise of the clock in the walls, why do you stop them at night?"
Jonathan sighed.
"I don't stop them every night. Some nights I just walk around checking all the rooms. It makes me feel secure somehow. I can't explain it. But some nights, like this one, I get the urge to stop all the blasted everlasting ticking. I get the feeling that if I were to make the house quiet, perfectly quiet, then maybe I could hear the real clock, the magic one, ticking behind one particular wall, or in some cubbyhole. But it never works, and I always feel half crazy for trying."
Lewis still looked puzzled. "If it's a magic clock," he said slowly, "then wouldn't it be invisible? I mean, wouldn't it be something you couldn't actually put your hands on?"
Jonathan shook his head.
"Not really, Lewis. Most magic is accomplished with solid, everyday objects. Objects that have had spells said over them. One which I knew tried to obliterate her enemy by leaving a photo of him under the running water of her gutter spout. Her reasoning was that he would die when the face on the picture was wiped out. It's a common method. No, Lewis. This is a clock. As real as Grandpa over there. Only it's enchanted. But what it is enchanted to do, I don't for the life of me know."
"Well, I know something, Weird Beard," said Mrs. Zimmerman, dangling her watch like a pendulum before Jonathan's eyes. I know that if we don't catch just a little, teeny bit of shut-eye, we're all going to be wearing our crabby caps in the morning. Lewis, off to bed. Jonathan, same with you. I'll rinse the cookie plates and put away the milk."
Later, up in his room, Lewis stood in the middle of the floor, staring at a patch of flowered wallpaper near the fireplace. He walked quickly over to the wall and put his ear to it. Yes, the ticking was here too. He walked across the room and listened to another wall. More of the same. Lewis walked back to the center of the room, and then abruptly he began to pace. He paced in quick strides with his hands behind his back, the way he had seen his father do when he was upset. He paced and tried to think logically. But logic wasn't much help where the clock in the walls was concerned. So, at last, Lewis gave it up. He jumped into bed and went to sleep. Chapter 3. On the first Monday after Labor Day, Lewis started going to school in New Zebedee, and before long he had forgotten all about the mysterious clock in the walls. He had troubles enough of his own. They weren't new troubles. They were the troubles that a fat boy who can't play baseball carries around with him from place to place. Lewis had always been overweight. He couldn't remember a time when he hadn't been. All his life, all 10 years of it, he had been listening to children who chanted, "Fatty, fatty, 2x4, can't get through the kitchen door." Sometimes he wanted to beat up the kids who made fun of him, but he couldn't box, and he wasn't very strong. That was another problem. But the worst problem of all was the baseball problem. Lewis still spun all the way around when he swung at a ball, and he threw his bat. At first he tried to excuse himself by saying, "Watch out, I'm going to throw the bat." But the other kids said, "Look, you throw the bat and we're going to beat you up. You hang on to it when you swing or you can't play." That's what they said when they let him play, which was not very often. Most of the time, when he lined up to be chosen, he was the last one left. And the captain of the side that was supposed to take him usually said, "Why do we have to take him? He can't field, he can't hit, he can't pitch, he can't even run. Come on, we'll play one man short." What they said about Lewis was true. Sometimes a new boy or a kind boy would get to be captain, and he would choose Lewis for his team. But when Lewis came to bat, he usually struck out. If he hit the ball, it popped up and the pitcher caught it. Or he might ground out to first base. When his team was out in the field, the boys made Lewis play right field because not many balls got hit out that way. But when one did, Lewis always dropped it, unless it hit him on the head. He would stagger back and forth as he tried to keep track of the ball that hung there high over his head, but he always got dizzy and covered his face with his glove and screamed, "No, no," as the ball came down. After a while, even the kind boys turned him down. One afternoon, when the usual routine had been gone through and Lewis had run off the field sobbing because they would not let him play, he found himself standing at home plate on a baseball diamond that wasn't being used that day. At his feet was a bat, a thick old club with a split handle that had been wrapped up with black friction tape. There was a softball nearby, or what was left of one, a black, sticky, egg-shaped lump covered with string. Lewis picked up the ball and bat. He threw the ball into the air and swung at it. He missed. He picked the ball up and tried again. Again he missed. He was about to try for the third time when someone said, "You're doing it all wrong." Lewis turned and saw a skinny boy about his own age squatting next to the bicycle rack. There was a big fluff of brick-red hair on top of the boy's head, and his right arm was in a sling. The boy was Tarby. Everybody in the school knew who Tarby was. Even Lewis knew, and he had only been in New Zebedee for a couple of months.
Probably everyone in New Zebedee and most of the people in Capernaum County knew who Tarby was. At least that was the impression that Lewis got. Tarby was the most popular boy in the school. He was a daredevil, the kind of boy who rode his bicycle through bonfires and hung by his knees from the limbs of trees. All the girls liked him, and he was the big home run hitter in the softball games. He got chosen first so often that most of the time the boys made him a captain just to avoid all the fighting over who got to have Tarby on their team. But here he was with his arm in a sling, watching Lewis as he tried to hit the ball. "I said you're doing it all wrong. You're supposed to keep your feet planted flat. Then you swing from the hips. Here, let me show you." Tarby scrambled to his feet and walked over to where Lewis was standing. He grabbed the bat and hefted it in one hand, choking up on it a bit. "Okay," he said. "Get out there and pitch. Just lob it up here." Lewis had never seen anyone trying to hit a ball with the bat held in only one hand. He was afraid that Tarby would miss and get mad and go home. With a nervous grin on his face, Lewis lobbed the ball toward the plate. Tarby swung and the bat connected. Clack! It struck the ball with that rickety, hollow sound that split bats have. The ball shot on a line toward center field. It would have been a clean single. "See? And that's just with one arm. You ought to be able to do that well with two. Come on, I'll pitch." Lewis walked in from the pitcher's mound and took the bat from Tarby's hand. "I didn't know your arm was broken," said Lewis shyly. "How'd you do it?" "Fell out of a tree. I was hanging by my knees, upside down like in the monkey house. It's okay, it'll heal up." Tarby walked out to the mound. Lewis pounded his bat on the plate and waved it the way he had seen George Kell do in Briggs Stadium in Detroit. But when Tarby threw the ball, Lewis missed, as usual. Every day, for the next 2 weeks, Tarby met Lewis after school, and they practiced batting. Slowly, gradually, Lewis's swing got better. He even managed to hit a few line drives. But something even more important was happening. Lewis and Tarby were getting to be friends. Tarby liked Lewis's jokes, and Lewis found out that Tarby hated some of the kids that he hated. Lewis liked Tarby's imitation of Mrs. Fondreiter, a mean teacher at school. Mrs. Fondreiter always called her husband Gerald, which was a funny thing to do. Tarby made a loop in the end of a green twig and pretended it was an eyeglass on a stick. Then he would stare through the loop at Lewis and say in a high voice, "How dare you say such things to me, Gerald?" Then Lewis and Tarby would sit around, planning how they were going to take care of Carol K. Labberdine, a snotty girl in the 6th grade who got away with murder because her father was on the school board. It was usually dark by the time Lewis and Tarby said goodbye to each other by the mailbox at the bottom of High Street. One afternoon early in October, Lewis and Tarby were out at the athletic field playing flies and grounders. Lewis had gotten good enough so that he could hit Tarby some pretty long fly balls. Tarby's arm was still in a cast, but he picked off the line drives and caught the pop flies as easily as if he had had two hands. Lewis was out in the field. It was getting dark, and he was having trouble seeing the ball, and besides, he was a little bored. He stood there thinking, or doping off, as Tarby called it. He wanted to do something nice for Tarby. Something nice that would really impress him and make him a stronger friend than ever. Maybe he could get Uncle Jonathan to do a magic trick for Tarby. Sure, that would do it. Lewis hesitated a minute, remembering Jonathan saying that he was only a parlor magician, the kind that pulled rabbits out of hats and told you what card you were holding in your hand. But then he had said that he knew a few tricks that went beyond that. Lewis thought some more. Oh, well, Jonathan could probably do it. Anyone who could make windows change their pictures could do what Lewis had in mind. And anyway, Lewis thought that he remembered hearing Jonathan say that he had done such a thing once. "Hey, Lewis, I hit the ball out to you about 6 hours ago. Did you go to sleep?"
Lewis looked up.
"Huh? Oh, gee, I'm sorry, Tarby. Say, how would you like to see my uncle eclipse the moon?"
Tarby stared at him.
"What did you say?"
"I said, oh, come on, Tarby, let's go home. It's too dark to see the ball. Come on, and I'll tell you all about my Uncle Jonathan. He's a real wizard."
The two boys walked back under the streetlights, playing catch as they went. Lewis tried to explain about Uncle Jonathan's magic powers, but he could see that Tarby was not convinced.
"Boy, I'll bet your uncle can eclipse the moon. I'll just bet he can. He probably sits up in his room drinking beer, then he goes out and back and stares up at the moon, and boy, does it go round and round."
Tarby staggered out into the street and rolled his eyes. Lewis felt like hitting him. But he knew that Tarby could beat him up, so he just said,
"You want to see him do it?"
"Yeah," said Tarby in a sneery voice. "I want to see him do it."
"Okay," said Lewis. "I'll ask him tonight. When he's ready to do it, I'll let you know."
"Gee, I hope I won't have to wait too long," said Tarby sarcastically. "I really do want to see old Lard Guts eclipse the moo-hoo-hoo, moo-hoo-ha."
"Stop it. Stop making fun of my uncle." Lewis's face was red and he was almost crying.
"Make me," said Tarby.
"I can't, and you know it."
Tarby went on moo-hooing until they reached the khaki-colored mailbox at the foot of High Street. This time, when they split up to go home, Lewis didn't say goodbye to Tarby. He didn't even wave. But by the time he was inside the gate at 100 High Street, Lewis had gotten over his mad, more or less, and so he went straight inside to see his uncle. He found Jonathan laying out a game of solitaire on the dining room table. It was a complicated game called Napoleon at St. Helena, and the layout covered most of the ivory-colored oilcloth pad. Jonathan looked up and smiled as Lewis walked into the room.
"Hi, Lewis. How's baseball these days?"
"Getting better, I guess. Tarby helps me a lot."
"Say, Uncle Jonathan, do you suppose we could do something nice for Tarby? He really is a good friend of mine."
"Sure, Lewis. We'll invite him to dinner. Is that what you mean?"
Lewis blushed and fidgeted.
Well, yeah, kind of. Do you think that maybe after dinner we could, that is, you could eclipse the moon for him?"
Jonathan stared at him.
"Did I tell you I could do that?"
"Yes. Remember one night when you were bragging, talking to Mrs. Zimmerman about whether earth magic was stronger than moon magic? You said that a moon wizard could eclipse the moon any time he felt like it, and that you were a moon wizard."
Jonathan smiled and shook his head.
"Did I say that? My, my, how I do run on. Let me see. I do seem to recall eclipsing the moon one night in 1932. That was during a picnic out at Wilder Creek Park. I remember the date, April 30th, which is Valpurgis Night. That's the night when witches and warlocks all over the world get together for whoop-de-doos. Ours was just a convention of the Capernaum County Magicians Society, but some of them are real wizards. At any rate, to get back to what I was saying..."
"Never mind," said Lewis, turning away with a pouty look on his face. "I'll tell Tarby that you can't do it."
"Oh, Lewis," cried Jonathan, throwing the pack of cards down on the table. "You are the most easily discouraged boy I ever met. If I did it once, I can do it again. It's just that it's not a normal occurrence. And everything has to be just right, in the heavens, that is."
"Oh."
"Yes, oh. Now, as soon as I have won this silly game from myself, you and I will go to the library and consult the almanac. So be quiet for a minute."
Lewis fidgeted and clasped and unclasped his hands and stared at the light fixture until Jonathan finished his game. Then the two of them went to the library,
slid back the paneled doors, and entered the marvelous room that smelled of damp paper, wood smoke, and Turkoman's Terror, Jonathan's personal tobacco blend. Jonathan moved the stepladder to the part of the wall that contained his magic books, climbed up, and pulled down a thick, dusty volume labeled Hardestes, Universal Omnium Gatherum, Perpetual Calendar Datebook, Almanac, and Book of Days. He flipped to the section on eclipses, did some rapid mental calculations, and said, "You're in luck, Lewis. 1948 is a good year for lunar eclipses. The planets will be favorable next Friday. Invite Tarby to dinner for that night. I'll be ready." Friday night came around, and Lewis brought Tarby home for dinner. There was nothing especially magic about the meal, except that the cider jug on the table burped a lot, and that might have been because the cider was getting hard. After the dishes were cleared away, Jonathan asked Lewis and Tarby to help Mrs. Zimmerman carry some kitchen chairs out into the backyard. Then he walked out into the front hall and consulted his cane rack, a blue willow-ware vase full of walking sticks of all sizes and shapes. Some had ivory or bone handles, some were tough, crooked old pieces of hickory or maple wood, and some had thin, springy swords concealed inside. But only one cane was magic. It was a long, black rod of some very hard wood. At one end was a ferrule of polished brass, and at the other was a glass globe the size of a baseball. It seemed to be snowing inside the globe. Through the swirling little flakes you could see now and then an odd little miniature castle. The globe burned with an icy gray light. Jonathan picked up the cane, hefted it, and walked back toward the kitchen with it tucked under his arm. Out in the backyard, the audience was ready. Mrs. Zimmerman, Lewis, and Tarby sat in straight chairs facing the birdbath. It was a chilly, clear October night. All the stars were out, and a large full moon was rising over the four elm trees at the far end of Jonathan's yard. The screen door slammed, and everyone looked up. The magician had arrived. Without saying a word, Jonathan went around to the north side of the house. An old mossy rain barrel stood there against the sandstone wall. Jonathan looked into the barrel, breathed three times on the dark water, and with his left forefinger cut the faintly shimmering surface into four quarters. Then he leaned low over the mouth of the barrel and began whispering in a strange language. The three spectators had not left their chairs. Jonathan had told them to stay where they were, but they craned their necks around a good deal trying to figure out what the wizard was doing. The whispering, weirdly magnified by the mouth of the barrel, went on for some time. Lewis twisted way around in his chair, but all he could see was the dark shape of Uncle Jonathan and the faintly glowing gray globe of the magic cane. Finally, Jonathan returned. In one hand he held the cane, and in the other he had a saucepan full of rainwater. "Is your uncle going to wash his hair?" whispered Tarby. "Oh, be quiet," hissed Lewis. "He knows what he's doing. Just you watch." Tarby, Lewis, and Mrs. Zimmerman watched anxiously as Jonathan poured the saucepan into the birdbath. Then he went back to the rain barrel for more. Dip, splash. He came back with another panful. He emptied it, and he went back for a third. The third panful seemed to be enough. Jonathan set down the empty pan and picked up his cane, which had been leaning against the birdbath. The glass ball glowed and sent out a ray of dusty gray light. The ray rested on the surface of the water in the birdbath. Jonathan made signs over the water with the cane and started muttering again. "Come on and look,"
he said, motioning to the three spectators. They got up and walked over to the birdbath. The water in the flat, shallow concrete pan had started to heave and pitch, like ocean water in a storm. Lewis was surprised to see tiny white caps forming. Then long rollers began to crash silently into the rim, sending pinpoint flecks of foam out onto the grass. Jonathan watched for a while along with the rest. Then, suddenly, he raised the cane and cried, "Peace! Peace to the waters of the earth! Show unto us the round disk of the moon, even as she now appeareth in the heavens above." The water calmed down. Soon it was a flat pool again. And floating on the still black surface was the cold reflection of the full moon. Now Jonathan did something very unlikely. As the others watched, he bent over and pulled a small boulder out of the pile of rocks at the base of the birdbath. Then, lifting it high in the air, he shouted, "Stand back!" and dropped the rock. Splash! Water slopped everywhere, and Lewis didn't get out of the way soon enough to keep from getting some on his shoes. When the water had calmed down again, Jonathan picked up the rock and looked into the pool. There, wobbly and creased with ripples, was the moon's reflection. "Still there?" said Jonathan, grinning. "Well, we'll just see about that." He reached down into the water and picked up the reflection. It might have been a trick, but the cold, icy gray disk he held up looked like the reflection that had floated in the pool a moment before. And sure enough, when Lewis looked into the water, all he saw now was a shiny blackness. Jonathan held up the reflection and turned it back and forth as if it were a dinner plate. The disk burned cold and bitter, and sparkled like freshly fallen snow. It hurt Lewis's eyes to stare at it for very long. Now Jonathan snapped his wrist and sent the disk flying across the yard. It sailed clear across to the dark thicket in front of the four elm trees. Then Jonathan, cane in hand, ran off after the disk. It was a long yard, and even in the moonlight the boys and Mrs. Zimmerman could not see what he was doing down there. Suddenly, the air was filled with the inane glockling and blockling of bamboo wind chimes. There was a set of them hanging from one of the elm trees, and Jonathan had given it a good hard yank. Now he came dancing back up the yard, dueling with shadows and saying things like, "Ha! Have at you in your bladder for a blackguardly slacker! Huh! Huh! And the third in his bosom!" He stopped in front of the birdbath and held the ball of the cane up under his chin so that his face looked like an actor's face when it is lit from below by footlights. Slowly, he raised his right hand and pointed at the sky. "Look!" he cried. All three of the spectators looked up. At first they saw nothing strange. Then, slowly, a black, tarry, drippy shadow oozed down over the face of the surprised moon. In no time at all, the moon was dark. Completely dark, blacked out, without even the faint brownish umbra that marks its place during an ordinary eclipse. And now, Uncle Jonathan's backyard came to life. It was full of strange sights and sounds. The grass glowed a phosphorescent green, and red worms wriggled through the tall blades with a hushing sound. Strange insects dropped down out of the overhanging boughs of the willow tree and started to dance on the picnic table. They waltzed and wiggled in a shaking blue light, and the music they danced to, faint though it was, sounded to Lewis like "Rug Bug," the famous foxtrot composed by Maxine Hollister. This was one of the tunes that Jonathan's parlor organ played. Uncle Jonathan walked over to the tulip bed, put his ear to the ground and listened. He motioned for the others to join him. Lewis put his ear to the damp earth, and he heard strange things. He heard the noise that earthworms make as they slowly inch along, breaking hard black clods with their blunt heads. He heard the secret, inwound conversations of bulbs and roots, and the breathing of flowers. And Lewis knew strange things, without knowing how he came to know them. He knew that there was a cat named Texaco, buried in the patch of ground he knelt on. Its delicate ivory skeleton was falling slowly to pieces down there, and its dank fur was shriveled and matted and rotten. The boy who had buried the cat had buried a sand pail full of shells near it. Lewis didn't know the name of the boy or how long ago he had buried the cat and the pail, but he could see the red and blue pail clearly. Blotches of brown rust were eating up the bright designs, and the shells were covered with green mold. After a long while, Lewis sat up and looked around. Tarby was kneeling near him, his ear to the ground and his eyes wide with wonder. But where was Uncle Jonathan? Where, for that matter, was Mrs. Zimmerman? At the far end of the yard, in the shadow of the four elm trees, Lewis thought he saw them moving around. He tapped Tarby on the shoulder, pointed, and the two boys silently got up and went to join the magicians. When they found them, Jonathan was arguing with Mrs. Zimmerman, who argued right back, though her ear was pressed flat to the ground. "I say it's the old storm sewer system," she muttered. "It was lost track of in 1868 because the charts got thrown out with the waste paper." "Well, you can think what you like, Frizzy Wig," said Jonathan as he knelt down for another listen. "I say it's an underground stream. Capernaum County is full of them, and it would account for the fact that Sin and Flesh Creek is much bigger when it leaves New Zebedee than it is when it enters it."
"You're full of beans, Fatso," said Mrs. Zimmerman, whose ear was still pressed to the ground. "I think I know the sound of water rushing through a brick tunnel. It's all vaulty and hollow."
"Like your head?"
Lewis and Tarby pressed their ears to the ground, but all they could hear was a sound like the one you hear when you press your ear against an inner tube that you're floating on in a lake. Lewis felt very excited. He wanted to be all over the garden at once, touching things and smelling them and listening. The magic in the backyard lasted for over an hour. Then the phosphorescence changed to plain old ordinary moonlight, and the moon floated high overhead, free from enchantments. As they walked back into the house, Lewis asked his uncle if the police department didn't get mad when he eclipsed the moon. Jonathan chuckled and put his arm around Lewis.
"No," he said, "strangely enough, they don't. I've never been quite sure why, but maybe it's because the eclipse is only visible in this yard."
"You mean it's not real?"
"Of course it's real. You saw it, didn't you? But one of the troubles with human beings is that they can only see out of their own eyes. If I could be two people, I'd station the other me across town to see if the eclipse was operating over there."
"Why don't you ask Mrs. Zimmerman to go watch?"
"Because she'd be crabby. She always wants to be in on things, don't you, Pruny?"
"Yes, I do, and right now I'd like to be in on some chocolate chip cookies. Why don't you all come over to my place?"
And that is what they did. Lewis was happy to have a chance to show off Mrs. Zimmerman's house to Tarby. It was not a mansion by any means. Just a little two-story bungalow with a screened-in front porch. But it was full of strange things, most of them purple. Mrs. Zimmerman had a thing about the color purple. Her rugs, her wallpaper, her staircase runner, her toilet paper, and her bath soap were all purple. So was the large surrealistic painting of a dragon that hung in her living room. It had been done for her specially by the French painter Odilon Redon.
as they munched their cookies and drank their milk and walked around looking at the purple things in Mrs. Zimmerman's house, Lewis noticed that Tarby wasn't saying much. When it came time for him to go, Tarby shook Jonathan's hand while staring at the carpet, and he mumbled, "Thanks for the cookies," to Mrs. Zimmerman in such a low voice that he couldn't be understood. Lewis saw Tarby to the front gate. He knew this was odd behavior for Tarby, who was usually loud and sassy acting even in front of grown-ups. "Thanks for the magic show," said Tarby, shaking Lewis's hand and looking very serious. "It was kind of scary, but it was fun. I take back all the things I said about your uncle, I guess. Well, see you around." And with that, Tarby went trudging down the hill. Lewis stared after him with a worried frown on his face. He hoped that Tarby had had a good time. Most people don't like to be proven wrong even when they enjoy themselves in the process. Tarby was a popular boy, and he was used to being right about everything. He had turned out to be wrong about Jonathan's magic powers. Now what would he do? Lewis didn't want to lose his only friend. Chapter 4. It was the last week of October, and Tarby's arm had almost healed. Lewis saw less and less of him now. He still waited for him on the baseball diamond out behind the school, and sometimes Tarby showed up, and sometimes he didn't. Of course, Tarby couldn't be expected to be very interested in flies and grounders at this time of year. The football season was getting underway. Lewis had seen Tarby playing football with the other boys after school. Needless to say, Tarby was always the quarterback. He threw long passes and made end runs and pulled off tricky plays like the Statue of Liberty. Lewis had thought of trying to join the football game, but he remembered what had happened back in Wisconsin. Whenever anyone charged over the line at him, he fell to the ground and covered his head with his hands. He couldn't catch passes, and if he tried to kick the ball, he usually wound up bunting it with his knee. Maybe if he got really good at baseball, he could get Tarby to teach him football next year. But he wasn't going to learn much about baseball without Tarby. Of course, these days he wasn't learning much, even with Tarby's help. On those rare occasions when Tarby showed up to play ball with Lewis, he seemed to want to get the game over with in a hurry. Lewis knew that he was losing Tarby, but so far he hadn't figured out how in the world he was going to hang on to him. One Saturday afternoon, when the two of them were poking around in the cemetery, Lewis had an idea. New Zebedee's beautiful old cemetery was on a high hill just outside of town. It was full of elaborate gravestones that showed weeping women leaning on urns and cupids extinguishing torches. There were pillars made to look as if they had been broken, and there were pillars with hands on top pointing up. There were little tombstones made in the shape of lambs, and these were over the graves of children. Some of the lambs had been there so long that they were worn into grimy white blobs that reminded Lewis of soap. On this particular day, Lewis and Tarby had been inspecting a lot where all the gravestones were carved to look like wood. Each grave was marked by a little granite log, complete with bark and rings and knot holes. The curb around the lot matched the tombstones, and in the center of everything rose a broken tree of stone. The top was jagged, as if lightning had struck it, and a stone woodpecker was whetting his beak on the realistically carved bark. Lewis and Tarby had been playing in this petrified forest for a while, but now they were getting tired. The sun, red as the tomato sun in Jonathan's stained glass window, was setting between two crooked pine trees. Lewis shivered and zipped up his jacket. "Let's go back to my house," he said. "Mrs. Zimmerman can make us some cocoa, and I'll show you some real petrified wood. My uncle got it in a forest out west that was actually turned to stone." Tarby looked bored, and he also looked mean. "Who wants to go back to your old uncle's house? It's a pretty crazy place, if you ask me. And how come old Mrs. Zimmerman is over there all the time? Is she in love with him?"
Tarby threw his arms around the stone tree and started kissing it with loud smacks. Lewis felt like crying, but somehow he managed to keep down the tears.
I bet you think all my uncle can do is eclipse the moon, said Lewis.
It sounded silly, but he couldn't think of anything else to say. Tarby looked interested, in a bored sort of way.
Well, he said, what else can he do?
Lewis didn't know why he said what he said next.
It just came to him. My uncle can raise the dead.
Tarby did a somersault over one of the log-shaped markers.
Oh, sure he can, he snorted. Look, your uncle is a fake. That night when he made it look like the moon had gone out and all that other stuff was happening, he just had us hypnotized. My dad told me that was probably what happened.
Lewis stared at him.
You said you'd never tell anyone about what we did that night, remember? I made you promise.
Tarby looked away.
Oh, yeah. I guess I did promise. Sorry.
Both of them sat quietly for a long while. There was nothing left of the sun but a faint red afterglow. A night wind had sprung up, and it stirred the long grass on the graves. Finally, Lewis got up and spoke. His voice came from way down in his throat.
What if I were to raise a dead person by myself?
Tarby looked at him. He giggled.
Boy, that would be some fun. I can see you running down Main Street in the middle of the night with a ghost after you.
Tarby got up and waved his arms.
Ooh, he wailed. I am the ghost of mystery. Ooh.
Lewis's face was getting red.
Want to see me do it?
Yeah, said Tarby. I do. When are you going to do it?
I'll let you know, said Lewis, although he didn't have the faintest idea of what he was going to do, or when he was going to do it, or how he was going to do it. All he knew was that he had to try, if he was going to hang on to his only friend in New Zebedee.
During that week before Halloween, Lewis spent a lot of time in his uncle's study. Normally it was okay for Lewis to browse in the library, but if Jonathan had known what books Lewis was looking at now, he would have stopped him. Lewis knew this, so he always waited till Jonathan was out visiting or raking leaves or tying up corn shocks in the garden. When he was sure he would not be disturbed, Lewis would slide back the paneled walnut doors, tiptoe into the study, and roll the stepladder down to the section of the library wall that contained Jonathan's magic books. Jonathan had forbidden Lewis to look through these books without his permission, so Lewis felt very bad about what he was doing. He felt bad about the whole business, but he went ahead anyway. He looked through all the strange old volumes, with their pentacles and pentagrams, their anagrams and talismans and abracadabras and long incantations printed in Old English lettering. But he spent most of his time with a big black leather volume entitled Necromancy. Necromancy is the branch of magic that deals with the raising of the dead. The frontispiece of the book was an engraving that showed Dr. John Dee, personal astrologer to Queen Elizabeth I of England, as he and his assistant, Michael Kelly, raised the spirit of a dead woman in an English churchyard at midnight. The two men were standing inside a chalk circle drawn on the ground. The border of the circle was covered with strange symbols and words. Just outside the charmed circle hovered a figure in a long nightgown. On her head she wore an odd, ruffly bonnet, the kind they once buried women in. Lewis kept turning back to the illustration because it frightened him. But he read the rest of the book. He read it all, and he memorized some of the charms. He even copied one of the pentagrams and the spell that went with it onto a piece of notepaper and put it in his pocket. Halloween was a windy, dark day. Lewis sat in the window of his bedroom and watched the wind strip the trees of the few ragged brown leaves that remained. He felt sad and scared. He was sad because he had disobeyed his uncle,
who was always kind to him. And he felt scared, because he had promised Tarby that he would meet him in the graveyard at 12 o'clock on Halloween night, so that the two of them could raise up the spirit of a dead person, or try to. Lewis didn't think it would work, and he was kind of hoping that it wouldn't. They had the grave all picked out. It was a mausoleum stuck into the side of the hill the graveyard was built on. Lewis didn't know anything about who was buried in the tomb, neither did Tarby. There wasn't even a name on the door. But whatever the name was, it probably started with O, because there was an O in the triangle over the heavy old stone arch. It was a funny kind of O, open at the bottom, like a horseshoe. At dinner that night, Lewis did not say much. This was odd, because he usually talked his head off about everything under the sun, especially those things he didn't know anything about. Jonathan asked him if he was all right, and Lewis said that of course he was all right. Anybody could see that. Jonathan and Mrs. Zimmerman exchanged worried glances and stared at him again. But Lewis went on eating, with his head down. At the end of the meal he pushed his chair back and announced that he was not going trick-or-treating because he was too old for it. "Does that mean that you're not coming over to my place for cider and doughnuts?" asked Mrs. Zimmerman. "Because if it does, I'll show up at midnight at the foot of your bed in my role of grinning Griselda, the resuscitated cadaver. It's a horrible thing to see." Lewis looked up. There was a wild look on his face, but he managed to force his mouth into a smile. "No, Mrs. Zimmerman," he said. "I wouldn't miss one of your cider and doughnut parties, not for the world, but right now I've got to go up to my room and finish one of John L. Stoddard's books. I've gotten to the exciting part." Whereupon he jumped up, excused himself, and ran upstairs. Jonathan looked at Mrs. Zimmerman.
"I have a feeling," he said, "that something is up."
"Hooray for your lightning-quick mind," said Mrs. Zimmerman. "Yes, something is up, and I have a feeling that we won't know what it is till it's over with."
"Maybe not," said Jonathan as he lit his pipe. "But I can't believe that Lewis is mixed up in anything bad. And I'm certainly not going to grill him like a mean stepfather. Still, I'd like to know what he's up to."
"So would I," said Mrs. Zimmerman thoughtfully. "Do you suppose it has anything to do with Tarby? The boy's arm is healing, and he'll probably be going back to play with the other boys soon. That leaves Lewis out."
Jonathan scratched his chin.
"Yes, maybe that's it," he said. "I'll have to have a talk with him. Oh, by the way, have you noticed that the clock is louder now?"
He was trying to sound nonchalant, but Mrs. Zimmerman could read the look in his eyes.
"Yes," she said, trying hard to smile. "I've heard it, too. And maybe if we ignore it, it'll just die down. It has before, you know. One thing for sure, you're not going to do any good by barging around the house with a crowbar, prying open the wainscot and peering between floorboards."
"I suppose not," said Jonathan, sighing. "Though I might come across the blasted thing by sheer persistence. On the other hand, that would mean wrecking the house, and I'm not quite ready to do that. Not until I have some clearer idea that the clock is something that can do us harm. And so far I'm just guessing. I'm even guessing when I say it's a real physical clock and not just some illusion left here by old Isaac Izzard to drive people mad."
"It's best not to think about the thing," said Mrs. Zimmerman. "Not until you have to, at any rate. You can't prepare for all the disasters that might occur in this frightening world of ours. If the devil appears, or if we find that the end of the world is at hand, we'll do something."
"Mm-hmm. We'll hide in the cellar. Come on, let's wash the dishes."
Lewis came down from his room at 10 o'clock and went next door to have cider and doughnuts. He found Jonathan and Mrs. Zimmerman waiting for him in the dining room. There was a big round oak table at one end of the long room, and it was covered with a clean checkered tablecloth. On the table stood a gallon jug of cider and a plate of powdered doughnuts, or fried cakes, as Mrs. Zimmerman called them. At the other end of the room, a violet fire crackled in the fireplace. Purple shadows rushed back and forth over the hearthrug, and over the mantelpiece, the purple dragon in the painting seemed to writhe and squirm. He looked very fierce indeed.
"Evening, Lewis," said Jonathan. "Pull up a chair and dig in."
After Lewis had eaten two or three doughnuts and downed four big glasses of cider, Jonathan announced that tonight's entertainment would be historical illusions, or famous scenes from the past. He asked Lewis what past scene he would most like to see. Lewis answered immediately, "I want to see the defeat of the Spanish Armada. Not the battle scenes, because I've read all about them in John L. Stoddard. But he doesn't tell what happened when they had to sail all the way around England and Scotland to get home. I want to see that part."
"Very well," said Jonathan. "Let's go over and sit by the fire."
They got up and walked over to the fireplace, where three big, comfortable chairs waited for them. When they were all settled, Jonathan pointed his pipe at the two electric candles over the mantelpiece. Slowly, the power began to drain from them. They flickered and went out. Then the bulbs in the chandelier over the table began to do the same thing. It was like watching the house lights dim in a theater. Lewis felt something tickling his nostrils and his tongue. It was the smell and taste of salt. Grainy, blowing mists filled the room, and Lewis found himself standing on a grassy headland. Jonathan was on his left, and Mrs. Zimmerman was on his right. Before them, a cold, gray sea tumbled and tossed.
"Where are we?" asked Lewis.
"We are standing on John o' Groat's," said Jonathan. "It is the northernmost point in Scotland. The year is 1588, and out there is the Armada, or what is left of it. You'll need the telescope to see them."
"Telescope?" said Lewis.
And then he realized that they were standing on a little stone platform behind a curving, waist-high wall. It was the kind of wall you find on scenic lookout points in state parks. And mounted on the wall was a small pay telescope with a set of instructions under glass. Lewis bent over and peered at the little card which said, "See the Armada. Last chance this year. Deposit 5 shillings if you please." Jonathan fumbled in his vest and dug out 2 large silver coins. He handed them to Lewis. They were 1/2 crowns, and each one was worth 2.5 shillings in old-fashioned British money. Lewis slid the coins into the slot. There was a whirring sound. He put his eye to the telescope and looked. At first, all he saw was a milky blur. But after he had fiddled with the adjusting wheel a bit, Lewis could see several big galleons plowing sluggishly through the waves. Their sails were ripped and torn, and their tattered rigging flew about crazily in the wind. The long rows of gun ports were closed tight against the battering sea, and Lewis could see patches on the sides of 3 or 4 ships. One lumbering hulk had a cable passed around its middle, presumably to hold it together. As Lewis watched, the ships wallowed on. Now he could see their tall, ornamented sterns. Saints and bishops and dragons supported gilded window frames or clung to scrolled corners. Lewis noticed that several statues had arms or hands or heads missing. One scowling bishop was wearing his mitre at a rakish tilt. Lewis turned the telescope. Now he was looking at a strange little man. The man was pacing the quarter-deck of the biggest, richest-looking, but most badly damaged ship of all. He wore a black cape that barely reached to his knees, and he was shivering. His whiskers were long and weepy, and he looked very worried.
"Who is the man on the biggest ship?" asked Lewis.
"That," said Jonathan, "is the Duke of Medina Sidonia. He is the Captain General of the Ocean Sea, which means that he is the commander of the Armada. The whole shot-riddled, sinking mess. I'll bet he wishes he were at home right now."
Lewis felt sorry for the poor Duke. When he was reading John L. Stoddard in bed the night before, he had wished that he could be there in the narrow seas, commanding a stout English galleon. He would have emptied broadside after broadside into the Duke's flagship until she sank. But now he wanted to help the man if he could. While Lewis stood thinking, Jonathan tapped him on the shoulder and pointed to something Lewis had not seen before. There, mounted on the wall, stood a cannon, a brass 24-pounder, with a wooden, step-sided carriage and ropes running from rings in the base of the carriage to rings in the wall. The ropes were to keep the gun from rolling down the hill after it fired.
"Come on, Lewis," said Jonathan, smiling. "Let's have a shot at the Armada. Isn't this what you've always wanted to do? It's all loaded and ready to fire. Come on."
Lewis looked as if he were going to be sick. Tears came to his eyes.
"Oh, no, Uncle Jonathan, I couldn't. The poor Duke and his men. Can't we do something for them?"
Jonathan stared at Lewis and rubbed his chin.
"You know," he said slowly, "for a boy who loves to play at sieges and war, you are remarkably peaceable. When confronted with the real thing, that is. Fortunately for you, however, this isn't the real thing. It's an illusion, as I may have said before. We're really still in Mrs. Zimmerman's dining room, with the table at one end and the purple fire at the other. If you go feel that rock there, it will feel remarkably like an armchair. The Duke and his ships out there are less real than smoke and mist, and so is that cannon. Go on, have a shot."
Lewis brightened up now. This would be fun.
A soldier appeared out of nowhere, dressed in the red costume of an English beef-eater. He handed Lewis a smoldering wick on a long rod.
Lewis applied it to the touch-hole of the cannon.
Boom!
The cannon jerked back against its ropes. Bitter smoke drifted past. Jonathan, who was fighting with Mrs. Zimmerman for the use of the Pei telescope, said,
"I think that—" "Oh, Guan, Florence, find your own peephole. I think—yes, you have brought down his fore-top-gallant spritsail."
Lewis felt pleased, though he didn't know what a fore-top-gallant spritsail was. The soldier reloaded, and Lewis fired again. This time he knocked a wooden bishop off the heavily ornamented poop deck. He fired several more times, and then Jonathan gestured, and another beef-eater came running up the hill carrying a wooden bucket full of sizzling red-hot cannonballs, or hot potatoes, as the Elizabethan sailors used to call them. The two soldiers loaded the cannon. First they poured in a keg full of powder. Then they stuffed in wet wadding to keep the cannonball from setting off the powder. Then came the cannonball itself. It hissed and steamed when it touched the wadding. Lewis applied the linstock again, and the gun leaped backwards. He watched the cannonball as it whizzed toward the Duke's galleon. It looked to him like a tiny, insane harvest moon. When the ball hit, the ship burst into flames. The weepy, bearded Duke sailed up toward heaven, playing a harp and sitting on a powdered doughnut. And now Lewis, Jonathan, and Mrs. Zimmerman were back in the dining room by the fire.
"Well," said Jonathan, rubbing his hands, "and what would you like to see next?"
Lewis thought a bit. He was so excited and happy that he had almost forgotten about what he had to do later that night.
"I'd like to see the Battle of Waterloo," he said.
Jonathan waved his pipe and the lights went out again. Now they were standing on a muddy hillside in Belgium. The year was 1815. It was raining,
a steady smoking drizzle that half hid the high hill opposite the one they were standing on. In the valley below,